I think we have a very interesting subject today, which is derived partly from the New Testament and partly from Chinese philosophy. That ought to make a very interesting blend. In the Bible, we are told that Jesus said to his disciples, "Suffer the little children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." On the other side of the world, Mencher says, "The child heart is the most important thing in the world, and the loss of the child heart is the greatest tragedy of all." So that this problem of the child seems to come into focus, especially in these days where there is so much uncertainty and discord in family relationships. If we go back to the philosophical concepts behind our way of life, we realize that this problem of the child has a very important key to the survival of humanity. We are inclined to feel that when a little child comes into the world, that it is a brand new little thing that had never existed before, that comes here completely ignorant, unable to take care of itself, and most of all, actually unable to understand the policies of material existence. Therefore, for a considerable period of time, sometimes running as long as 25 years, the child must be conditioned. It must be taught how to fit in to a hopeless situation. It must be warned against those very principles which we most find in children. We know that very small children are usually adorable little creatures. They have their peculiarities and can be problems sometimes. But all in all, they are a wonderful adventure for young parents starting out in life. There is something about the small child that almost resembles the doll. It is almost a plaything. Gradually, it becomes the moral responsibility of the parents to mold the career of this little one. And being perfectly reasonable people and believing fully in the reality of the circumstances around them, they proceed to help the child to adjust itself to the peculiarities and eccentricities of modern mortal human existence. The parent has no idea that there's anything more to the subject than appears on the surface. The religious person believes the child in some mysterious way descends from God. The materialist considers it simply a physical phenomenon. Actually, the parent very seldom questions any of these things. It simply assumes that it has been given a responsibility, and if it is a good parent, it tries to fill that responsibility as honorably as possible. So the parent begins to work on what it believes to be a completely new character. Now, it isn't long before this new character must be subjected to certain modifications. This little one is not completely a blank sheet of paper. It has a basic temperament, and each member of the parental family is inclined to trace this temperament to the other members' family. It is also assumed under the theory of Mendelianism that the child is now inheriting the burdens, responsibilities, problems, and miseries of perhaps several generations of ancestors. So all of a sudden the child doesn't even speak for itself. It opens its mouth and a grandfather's voice comes out saying all kinds of things the child would normally never have thought of. Nearly always these things that come out of the mouths of babes now have a peculiar ring to them. They seem to definitely imply that they belong to some type of previous behavior patterns, which the parent must cope with to the best of their ability. Now, the alternate theory, of course, of reincarnation is very important at this point. I think we should all realize, if possible, that the life of an individual is not measured in one embodiment. A person's real lifespan is the cycle of embodiments through which he passes. He is therefore a being that exists in long periods of time. And in these long periods of time, he is periodically reborn. And in these rebirths, he brings into manifestation the achievements of previous embodiments and the unfinished business of the remote past. Therefore, without knowing it, without the parents knowing it, the child is some way conditioned before it gets here. The next step is to realize that after it gets here, there is a period in which the child is simply incapable of expressing its own individuality to any great degree. In early infancy, the child is completely dependent. Therefore, depends upon the parents for survival, for nutrition, and to a measure, for environment. This environment, however, is new even if the child believes in rebirth or is taught rebirth. It's new because a previous embodiment some time back, it was an entirely different social problem. The individual simply could not move from the 14th to the 20th century and simply live out one pattern of circumstances. The 14th century is gone, yet the unfinished business lingers on. The environment of the 14th century no longer prevails, and the entire adjustment of the child to a physical environment must be contemporary. Therefore, out of an eternity and out of a past and out of a conditioning that is extended for ages, the child is dumped into our modern environment, into a world which has never, to our knowledge, existed before, a world in which values and circumstances are hopelessly confused. Therefore, the parent, or at least the educational system, or something or someone involved in protecting the integrities of children, such a person or condition has to take into account the need to protect and preserve the child from artificial involvements in irrational or inconceivable circumstances. For instance, the child coming in now, it becomes the duty of the parent to introduce him to a political structure that is in tragic difficulties, an economic system that has never actually worked, into a political and industrial system which really didn't exist much more than 100 or 200 years ago. He also has to face a religious problem which he may know something about in his subconscious. Therefore, some children seem to be born with a natural tendency to religion and others are not. But all of these problems come to the parent when the little one arrives, and it must be made to fit into the circumstances that it is going to face. By doing this consistently and relentlessly, the parent, trying to help the child to be happy, comfortable, and successful, binds it to a pattern which is entirely materialistic and physical in its emphasis. The child is taught how to live in a world where it is only going to remain for 70, 80, or 90 years, and then will return to an eternity to which it has belonged forever and will forever belong. The importance of this embodiment, therefore, while it is real, while it is significant, while it is a measure of testing and learning, is not the tremendous reason for embodiment. The individual does not come in this world primarily to add to the labor force. It is not here to determine that it can earn a living, that it may be one of a few who accumulate fortunes. It may have a professional standing. It may be famous or distinguished in life. But in the course of time, it simply disappears again into the invisible realms from which it came. Now, in our materialistic civilization, this little span of 70 or 80 years is all important. Nothing else really counts. Even our religion now is largely focused upon the effort to help us to be morally comfortable in an immoral atmosphere. It also tries to give us hope and aspirations, but builds us very little substance upon which to build or base such hope. So we are left now as a being in eternity, an everlasting creature, caught within the pattern of a physical embodiment, and largely over-influenced and over-conditioned as to the significance of this physical existence. Now, the mystics of all time have pointed out that someone, some way, must lay a foundation to help children and young people, and for that matter, so many of the older people, into a relationship with life that is significant, that has meaning, that does not allow us to be born, grow up, pass through a series of economic upheavals, retire on a pension, and die. This does not seem to justify any significant social or universal pattern. There's something wrong with the concept. And because of this wrong concept, we've had 50,000 years of history and prehistory that has been nothing but a vast cycle of dolefulness, of regrets, of sorrows, of violence, of constant unrest, and the individual forever sacrificed to the prevailing policy of his contemporary culture. This does not seem to work any significant good. It does not accomplish anything to justify the labor and problem of coming into this world, growing up, passing through all the phases of life, and then having nothing to look forward to at the end, but a quiet passing to where? No one seems to even be quite sure the answer to that question. So children coming into this world come into a situation that is very frustrating from the beginning. They come into families where the parents are as unhappy as they are going to be. They come into an environment in which very little is secure. They are sent to school to learn how to make a living or a profession, but they can graduate cum laude and at the same time make a bad marriage 6 weeks later. There doesn't seem to be any sense in it all. And the child gradually loses its most valuable value and part, and that is its childlikeness. Now, there are two different words we use in these terms. One is childishness, which is truly physical infancy or the senility of the aged. The other is childlikeness, and it is the childlikeness that greatly interested Mencius, the Chinese philosopher. In some mysterious way, from the cradle to the grave, we are and always will be children. The idea that we have grown up is not supported by actual evidence. The world in which we live cannot prove that even many of our most brilliant leaders are really mature. Maturity implies values. And no matter how successful a person is, if he is without values, he is not mature. So the average child growing up through the environment of his physical embodiment does not contribute much to his own maturity. He gradually loses track of himself. He forgets himself, and I becomes simply a first personal pronoun by which he intends to identify himself. He says, I want, but in substance he doesn't know what he wants. He says, I believe, but that belief is not strong enough to do him much practical good. I hope, that sounds rather helpful, but it's quickly undermined by adversity. I fear, this is much more common and is much more likely to be maintained over a period of time. Therefore, we keep saying, I do this, I believe that, I want this, I don't want that. And yet, we don't know what the I is that is asking the question, and we really don't know what it wants if it does reach out for something. And for the most part, if it reaches out for its own highest values, we are failures physically. We are unable to adjust to the commercialism of a contemporary culture. And many religions have developed mystical groups or organizations or societies or retreats for those who do not wish to become hopelessly entangled in the power struggle of our present generation. These people are quiet, mystical, hopeful, given to religious speculation, desirous of doing good works, charitable, and forgiving in nature. And to live this way, that seems to be the easiest method, is to retire from this terrific pressure of civilization. Unfortunately, again, the retirement doesn't work too well, because retirement causes the person to lose the experience wisdom which comes from struggling through it to the best of one's ability. So the retiring person usually disappears into a mystical haze for which he may never return. Still, it does not solve the main problem. Now, if we have a small child, and a rather lovable little creature at that, we begin to note that it has some kind of a nature or disposition of its own. Actually, it's very possible that that natural disposition may be more real than anything it's going to learn from outside contributions. The little child generally is strong in faith, has great affections for those that care for it, tries to be attractive in temperament, and gradually evolves into a more or less delightful member of the household. All this up to about the period of 3 years. After this, complications begin. Why? Because this little child is brought under the very strong pressure of family tradition. It is expected to follow the religion of its parents. And if its parents are orthodox, it is indoctrinated by the time it is 4 or 5 years old. It is supposed to like what the parents like, dislike what the parents dislike, and to always follow the wisdom of the parental guidance. And this parental guidance may be rather deficient in wisdom, and is in most cases. So the child gradually takes on conditions, as they used to say back in the 1920s, when popular psychology followed the take-on condition school, which was quite popular. Actually, the child finds gradually that the only way it can really get along nicely, as nicely as possible, is to do what other people want it to do, and to conform with whatever policy dominates the family into which it is born. This conditioning goes on, and as Comenius pointed out, the father of the modern public school system, we have now lost track of the fact that education usually begins when the child is born, and by the child goes to school the first time, the education is complete. In other words, it is educated before it ever goes to school. Now, by education, we do not mean it is enlightened, but it is under a pressure of conditioning, which is setting its character, establishing its beliefs, and hopefully increasing its morality and ethics. To therefore overlook, or forget the tremendous importance of early conditioning on the child is to contribute to the collapse of civilization. Mencius knew this, and so did Confucius. The neglected child is the greatest hazard that a nation can have. It is the greatest cause of the gradual corruption and disintegration of the social structure. This social structure, Confucius pointed out, consists at the beginning of certain recognitions and values. The family is a unit. The family is the basic unit of human society. It is the rock foundation upon which all cultures are built. It is the original government. It is the original system of education. It is also the basis of economic security, and by the contributions that it makes in various ways, it sets the example to lead the next generation into a little larger fulfillment of its purposes. Now, in the childhood home, there are certain restraints upon individual freedoms. In order to protect a child's character, there must be attention given to it. it must be brought into the realization of what constitutes a proper family situation. Now, this cannot be done by indoctrination. You can tell the child that it ought to do forever, but the child is keenly aware of actions, of the relationships of these adults to each other. Nothing that they can say, to kind of paraphrase Emerson, talks as loud as what they see their families do. So the child begins at an early age to require conditioning. The Chinese said, for example, that in the family there must be a kind of regimentation. There must be an order of procedure. There must be things that must always occur. All members of the family, living together or scattered and occasionally coming together, must always, under all conditions, treat each other with gentility, civility, courtesy, and understanding. It is a serious breach of family education for parents to nag at each other, shout at each other, or hate each other. This is not just detrimental to the family. It will ultimately bring down the nation. We don't realize that for lack of the horse nail, shoe nail, the war was lost, but it is in the social circumstances of mankind. Actually, the parents must never have a relationship among themselves that is not dominated by gentility, courtesy, and affection. Otherwise, this is going to be passed on to the child, and the child is going to begin to recognize that it should or could gain certain advantages by being unpleasant. And this is one of the earliest examples children follow. And the next thing that is important is that in family life, in the intimate relationships of life, there must always be gentility, thoughtfulness, mutual respect. Each member of the family must basically respect the other members, not tolerate them, not get along with them the best they can, but respect them and their rights and their privileges and their relationships, so that in the home, if it's to be a successful place for the rearing of children, the home must have a harmonious, genteel, constructive, idealistic atmosphere. Not read out of books, not necessarily by attending professional places of worship or education, but by natural recognition that the basic relationship of all humanity is fraternity. That we must all live together graciously, or dangers rise on every hand. So the child is taught this in the concept of Chinese guidance. The second thing the child is taught is that any action which it commits, which is wrong, which discredits it, which in any way is inconsistent with the family integrities, is a disgrace. And the disgrace falls not only upon the child, but upon his ancestors and his descendants. The wayward child is a disgrace to 10 generations of Chinese elders. It must therefore be that every move that is committed by a genteel person of good breeding must be acceptable, not only for himself, but for the family to which he belongs, and must be making a positive contribution to the future. This type of thing is very hard for us to understand. We would regard this as more or less a penalization system in which the individual is not permitted to do what he pleases. Well, in nature, if the truth were out, no one in this world is ever permitted to do what he pleases. He can only do what he pleases if what he pleases is right. And the moment it isn't right, infirmities begin to afflict him. And the right to be wrong does not exist in nature, nor does it convey any of the values which are important to life. So we have to figure that the child must learn always to speak respectfully to its elders, respectfully to its fellow children, brothers and sisters, respectful to the stranger who comes, to the friend who visits, and must bow with all the rest of the family before the ancestral tablets in the family shrine. These things are security. They are security when this child goes out in life, because it will be strengthened against corruption, against danger of wrong association, dissipation, extravagance, and all these things. This all belongs to an education that precedes schooling. And this is where, to a large degree, the world has drifted into trouble. The mature elders, the parental generation, is becoming ever more concerned with its own rights, with its own privileges, with its own willingness to do the things that are most pleasing to itself. The individual, the adult, now feels, very largely, that he has the right to live as he pleases, that he is entitled to all the liberties that he can possibly hold on to, that he is entitled to the highest standard of living to which he can attain. And if this results in an economic situation in which he must shortchange his own family, must fail to do those things which bring proper maturity to his children, then he is sacrificing the future for his own pleasure. This is the problem that Confucius faced when he went to the Duke of Lu and tried to influence the Duke to make him a prime minister of this province of China. The Duke more or less explained to him the facts of life, namely that he, as the Duke, was going to do exactly as he pleased, that he was going to favor those who favored him, advance those who advanced him, and give greatest attention to those who brought the largest revenues. This was such that Confucius then retired from public life and into his little school, where he continued to teach until the time of his death. Plato had the same experience. He had intended to run for Archon of Athens, one of the senators of the city. But after serving a very short time in Athenian politics, he retired permanently and also went into his little academy to create a private universe nearer to the will of God. So these things happen. And we begin to study the problem. Now the child's getting along. By this time, it has a number of bad habits. Habits which really didn't belong with itself. He didn't bring them with him when he came here. He got them when he was too young to resist them. He nags, he howls, he screams. If he doesn't get what he wants, he puts on a temper fit. And an harassed and embarrassed family will do almost anything he wants them to. The child's well-being is secondary to the comfort of the family that doesn't wish to be faced with problems. All this goes along, and finally the child reaches school age. By this time, the child's understanding of the world into which he has recently been introduced is apt to be rather faulty. He is already becoming convinced that there is nothing much he's ever going to be able to do to make anything any better, and that the most important thing he can do is to adjust himself to the corruptions of his contemporaries. He must follow some peer group of some kind. If he wants higher education, he can take his leadership from one of the more important universities. Here he will come under the peership of professors who will teach him exactly what they want him to know, and mostly they will teach him to disregard those subtle principles of inner life which are the basis of his true humanity. It is very difficult outside of a theological seminary to find a university that really fundamentally emphasizes the importance of soul power over mind or body force. The individual is being taught to make a living. In the process of making a living, he may be on the football team, he may become a basketball player, he may break a few ribs or something of that kind in the cause of good, clean fun. And gradually, he is reduced into a pawn in a great world of people. By the time he has graduated from his peer group and is settled in life, his horizon is so close that he can scarcely look beyond his own face. There is very little left for him. He must settle back into the routine problem that he has come to accept as inevitable. By normal circumstances, he may also take on a few responsibilities himself. And if he has a responsibility for a family, he will still further limit his own personal insights and his own integrities in order to provide for them. So it goes on, and generation after generation comes along, from Alexander the Great to Adolf Hitler, and the same things go on. War, crime, all these things, and they all begin, every generation, with a chubby little baby just coming into the world with a big grin, which gradually changes into a whale if it doesn't receive proper attention. So this is the way it all starts. These little children are the future dictators, the future politicians, the future executives of all kinds, and the future policy makers. They finally become the ones who vote for someone else. And their voting is judged largely by the inducements of their environment. So the child moves from an internal life, which it brings with it, to an environmental pattern, which it must gradually assume as it would take on a suit of clothes. Therefore, the outer life of the individual is regarded as a garment. It is something that he has to wear, and that must be cut according to the style of the time and place where he lives. Then this garment has gradually come to be mistaken for himself. He is supposed to be what he wears. He is supposed to be exactly what he says after he has been conditioned to the degree that he no longer speaks for himself. All this type of thing is against the better good of each of us. Now, how long can we say that this childhood lasts? Well, it's hard to say, but I think the easiest way to summarize it is that childhood of the kind that we are concerned with extends from the cradle to the grave. The individual always has the child heart. It always belongs in some way to childishness. And many of its so-called mature actions are infantile. It makes more stupid mistakes than you can possibly classify. It seems to lack common sense, judgment, and all of these things, but it has been trained out of the big smile that it had when it was a small child. All of these mysteries which the child faces with wonder, we face with anxiety and morbidity. Actually, therefore, all the way along, the problem of restoring, protecting, or recreating childlikeness is very, very important. And what is childlikeness? What are the virtues of a child which has been given some attention and is allowed to develop some of its natural functions? If it has not been hurt, damaged, or interfered with by circumstances of early life, the natural instinct of the child is to be lovable. Its natural instinct also is to realize that it is living in a very large world. From the time when the little tyke reaches up to try to get hold of the doorknob, it begins to know that it lives in a world of beings and creatures larger than itself, and in the midst of which he or it is a Lilliputian. It is a mere tininess, surrounded by things that are much bigger and stronger and more powerful. These things that are so big and powerful gradually come to play the part of God. They become the divine powers that are inevitable and infallible. And while this condition goes on, the child generally has some reasonable protection, unless the parents tear it down themselves. But as it goes further into life and begins to try to live out its destiny, there's something else comes in that usually has to mature a little bit before it has a chance to express itself, and that is experience. We gradually come to experience the fact that most of the things that we believe are doubtful, and some are complete falsehoods. We also learn to believe by gradual means that some way, somehow, there is something that is a better guide to life than we are accustomed to accept. We begin to realize that scholasticism has very serious limitations,
and that nearly all great thinkers have themselves revolted against it. We also began to think of what we call common sense. Common sense is something that seems to be an inward rationalism. It is an inward honesty. If common sense can be particularly impressed as a term, it would be that it is honesty. It is the effort to achieve the reality of things. And if we turn common sense upon the world as we know it, we're going to get quite a shock. So the best thing that we can do for most people is not to permit that to occur. They are not going to allow truth, common judgment, reality, experience, and the ideals that have descended to us from the past to become too much involved in daily actions. If we do, we are going to be hurt too badly. Common sense is one of the things the child brings with it. Why? Because it has already had long experience in it. The child that comes into the world is naturally burdened with unfinished business. It comes not as a brand new thing. It comes as a burdened creature. A creature burdened by its own unfinished and unregenerated past. A burden of things yet to be achieved and accomplishment. A debt to be paid. An opportunity to be created. A step forward in integrities and values. These things are part of the heritage that comes with the child into its own embodiment. As a result of that, the child gradually either releases something of itself in the form of its needs, or it is blocked in this procedure, and what it really needs is locked within itself, and it takes on the heavy burdens of worldliness as it is around us. The problem, therefore, of common sense is that somewhere lurking in the inner part of each one of us is a considerable honesty. There's a wonderful, strange value inside of us. Worldliness cannot kill it, but it can lock it, for it is no longer easily available. Each person has the possibility of being led by the soul power within itself. And that soul power is born of experience. It is born of having learned the very severe and real facts of life over a long period of time, over many embodiments, until certain values become increasingly clear. And when we leave any embodiment, we take this added clarification with us in the future. So the child does have these basic values, which we might generally call common sense. Some people might call them intuition. Others may consider them a mystical attribute. But in reality, they are simply the truth of existence, moving in gradually upon the life of the individual. We never will get it all at once. The truth of the existence of which we are a part is accumulated over hundreds of embodiments, but it grows a little each time, so that we come just a shade nearer the truth. And the truth that we have to learn are many different types and styles and kinds, but they all are important to the growth of the person. One of the first things that we have to learn is to recognize the importance of inner guidance. This guidance that we have brought with us into life and which we have blocked consistently for years. Now, if we continue to block this inner guidance indefinitely, we will bring into action a series of mistakes. If we don't listen to it, or if we resist it, or we are unable to recognize this integrity if someone else communicates it to us, when this goes on long enough, we are in trouble. We begin to have suffering. Misery closes in. Misery is caused primarily by departure from the plan to which we belong. Misery is the individual who is not doing it the way it should be done. Misery is therefore something that most people want to get over. But there's no pill to take that pain away. There is only change of character and integrities. Now, even the small child, or at least the growing child, in early friendships with teachers and playmates and all these local associations, does learn some little things. he begins to see what another child who is too selfish is doing, or some bully in the junior grade is not keeping the peace, keeping the integrities that are right. And each of us instinctively notices what is wrong, or thinks we can notice it. But when it happens, we just simply walk away from it because we don't know what to do with it or what is right instead. We just keep on struggling with it. So we have to begin to think in terms of unfolding the potential within our own nature in some basic way. Some children have brought with them a different karmic pattern from others. The karmic patterns are more difficult where the previous conduct of the individual himself has been difficult or unfruitful. Many persons have lived many lives very selfishly, self-centeredly, violently. They've had false values on all levels, so that when they are reborn, they are going to be inevitably associated in some way with conditions which in the past they have imposed upon others. The individual who has bullied others over a long period of time must finally be brought in line by being the victim of being bullied by someone else. It is only in this way, apparently, that many people are able over a long period of life to correct the evils that they have allowed to develop within themselves. So when we start out with the problems, we try to figure out how to straighten out the life we live. And I know some little children that worked out some pretty good ideas on this. I knew a little girl who was came from a fairly comfortable family, and the family provided her with a sandbox. I suppose very few people now know what a sandbox is. A sandbox is a little box-like thing, maybe 4 or 5 feet long, and the same width, with about 6 inches of dry sand in it. Now, this is the basis of a whole world, because you can wet the sand down a little and begin to make it into all kinds of things. And in a little time, you'll build a castle in the sandbox. And another day, you'll build a garden. You can build houses and towers and monuments, or you can build all kinds of interesting shapes just in the sand, like mountains and valleys and all this type of thing. So one day while I was watching this, I saw that the girl had made a very nice house with a little roof and chimney and everything, all of wet sand. So I said, too bad that isn't going to last very long.